Hello and welcome back to the Earfuel podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can follow me on Twitter at @GetEarfuel and at The Daily Guru. The podcast is always available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Earfuel and at GetEarfuel.com. So this week, I'm going to once again delve into the truth behind some more music urban legends, and it's going to get wild. So before we let the wheels fall off of this thing, a very quick album review. The record I want to look at today is the brand new release from Deep Valley, and it's called Femagism. Yep, Femagism. They have a way with words. Now, if you don't know Deep Valley, you really should, and just so you know, it's spelled D-E-A-P-V-A-L-L-Y. Anyway, it's the duo of Lindsay Troy and Julie Edwards, and they sit somewhere between garage rock, metal, blues rock, funk. It's just full octane rock glory. Really, you have to check them out. Their last album, Systrionics, was and is one of my favorites of the past few years, and I was hoping that this record would be more of the same kick-ass, totally righteous rock and roll awesomeness. The first side of this album is outright spectacular. Song after song just makes you want to turn it up louder and louder, and these songs, they're going to have you rocking out big time. From the slight fuzz on the song Julian, to the feminist middle finger of the song Smile More, to the insane tone on Grunge Band, this record never lets up and never lets you down. Yeah, you know where that thought's going. Anyway, I really dig that heavy, thumpy, stomp thing that they do that in many ways defines their sound, and it's rarely been better than you find on the song Little Baby Beauty Queen. I mean, really, for all of you wondering where real kick-ass rock and roll is in 2016, it's right here on this album. It's a reminder that rock as a form is alive and well, and when it's done without the constraints of a major label, it's left to breathe as it needs to. Sort of along that line, the lyrics here are phenomenal, and it very quickly exposes how fake most of these pseudo-feminist pop stars in the spotlight there are out there. You know, those who come up with a half-assed, half-meaningful hook that are kind of more about record sales and actually about empowering people. You know who I'm talking about. Yeah, well, this is about empowerment. Tracks like Gonna Wanna and Smile More prove that, and it's done in a way that's really for everyone. I mean, it's just two people here. Killer guitar, killer drums, and they are so locked in, it's silly. This is just a musical performance you have to check out, and when you're done listening to this album, go get Systrionics. I mean, I can't say enough about this album. It's a fantastic rock and roll ride that everyone needs to be a part of. So if you're not already on the Deep Valley bandwagon, go grab this record, crank it up, and get in on the next big thing. Moving on. A few weeks back, I spent the episode discussing the truth or lies behind some of my favorite music myths and urban legends. Following that episode, lots of you asked for more, and even some of you sent in stories that you wanted me to explore. So that's what I'm going to do this week. Four new stories to uncover the truth about, and we're going to start with none other than the Prince of Darkness himself, Ozzy Osbourne. Now, there are so many urban legends about Ozzy, as in the late 70s and early 80s, he was about as wild as they get. But amongst all the great stories about Ozzy, the claim that he bit the head off of a live bat certainly stands in a category all its own. It's been mocked in TV, movies, and it's unquestionably one of the best-known rock stories ever. But did it actually happen? The story goes back to January 20th, 1982, whilst Ozzy was on a solo tour right before the release of his Diary of a Madman album. Great record. He was on stage in Des Moines, Iowa, and a 17-year-old fan named Mark Neal had a bit of an odd idea. See, most versions of this story say something like Ozzy did this stunt every single night, you know, where he bit the head off of a fake bat, and that night, for whatever reason, his crew put a real one in or something like that. That's just not true. It's actually a bit stranger than that. This fan, Mark Neal, decided for whatever reason to bring the bat to the gig and throw it on stage. Now, the venue Ozzy was playing that night was about a 5,000-seater, so while it's not super small, it wasn't a massive stadium like Sabbath had been playing for the last two decades, so there was a good chance he would be able to get that bat on stage. Another key point is that the bat was dead. Upon later inspection, some of Ozzy's crew referred to it as rancid, so it was way dead, and he brought it to the venue in a plastic bag. I mean, I would have loved to have heard that interaction at security. Do you have any knives or chains on you, sir? No, just this dead bat in a bag. oh, okay, enjoy the show, or something like that. That's how it happens in my mind, and I like how things are in my mind. Anyway, so Mark tosses the bat on stage, and Ozzy assumed that it was fake, and he bit into its head, which came off in his mouth. In his autobiography a few years back, Ozzy said that his mouth was, quote, instantly filled with this warm, gloopy liquid with the worst aftertaste you could ever imagine. Yeah, he ended up actually going to the hospital at the show to get shots for rabies. It totally happened. And just for the record, the story of Ozzy biting the head off of doves is also completely true. Two, in fact, and it was in a meeting with executives from CBS Records. Now, apparently, this was a few years earlier, Sharon Osbourne had arranged for Ozzy to publicly thank them for all the work leading up to the Blizzard of Oz album release. And at the end, you know, Ozzy would release three white doves, I guess for like a wow factor or something like that. Well, apparently, the Ozman was well beyond drunk when he arrived at the speech in question, and some PR woman asked him in a rather rude tone if he liked animals. So to silence her, and because he's pretty drunk and he was Ozzy, he grabbed one of the doves and bit its head off. And then he decided he'd do it with another one, and he spit the head of the second one out onto the table in front of the woman. Gruesome, but true, and he was then obviously thrown out of the CBS offices. Now, we will get into more Ozzy legends down the road, but for now, let's just keep him away from any winged animals, shall we? Jumping ahead a decade, we all remember when Lauryn Hill was somebody on people's minds, and she was dropping brilliantly brutal verses all across the Fugees' classic album, The Score. I love that record. After that group dissolved, she had a briefly successful solo career, and during that time, there was a claim that she made a rather infamous statement. The myth itself states that she said she'd rather her children go hungry as opposed to white people buying her music. And while there are slight variations on the statement, often saying, you know, she'd rather die than white people buy her music, or that she'd never have recorded the album if she knew white people are going to buy it, the core of it is almost always the same, and that core is basically that she hates white people. Now, Lauryn Hill has never been afraid to speak her mind, and she's more than politically switched on, so it's not out of the question that she might say something like this, so let's dig in and see what truth we find. The story actually dates back to 1996 on none other than the Howard Stern Show. A caller made the claim that Lauryn made the statement during an MTV interview, and when you have a listener reach like Howard Stern did in 96, lots of people are gonna start talking. So, did it happen? Well, if you ask anyone at MTV if such footage exists, they will say 1,000% no. In fact, just a few days after that call happened, MTV made a public statement where they said there was no interview in their possession where Hill made a statement even remotely similar. Then on May 21st, Hill herself called into Stern's show to refute the claim, but it didn't really end there. See, just a few months later, she kinda did say that when she said, quote, "I love my people, black people, and I will continue to make music for them." This quote got all sorts of white people into a tizzy, as they read it one way which, even after a few moments of logical thought, is the wrong way to interpret it. Hill, to me at least, was saying that her music is there to support and inspire people with similar roots and upbringing than she had, and while it doesn't exclude white people, there is a different focus. Is that racist? I don't know. That's for each of you to decide. But the fact remains that Lauryn Hill never said she didn't want white people buying her music. It's total myth. Next up, let's take a look at one of the darker urban legends of music, and one that we briefly touched on a few weeks ago in a roundabout way. The story stems from the opening track of the Rolling Stones' 1969 classic Let It Bleed, and that song is, of course, Gimme Shelter. When we discussed analog versus digital and the ability to retain unexpected moments in the former, I played the isolated vocals from this track, so you could all hear Mick Jagger give a big ol' woo when backing vocalist Mary Clayton absolutely destroyed her vocal solo on that song. Mary's performance on Gimme Shelter is unquestionably one of, if not the greatest backing performance in history, as she's singing so hard that her voice breaks a few times. I mean, you can feel the power and the passion behind it, and it's that moment that led to one of the longest-running music urban legends ever. As the story goes, following her recording, she suffered a miscarriage because of how hard she sang. It's pretty grim, I know, but there are some very clear facts that made this more than just an urban legend, so let's hop in the Wayback Machine to the recording studio in November of 1969. The basics of the song had already been recorded, and they were mixing the tracks. So just a bit before midnight, Jimmy Miller, who was producing the song, turned around and said that he absolutely heard a girl's voice on the track, and that someone needed to get a singer down to the studio right then and there. Another producer on the track called Mary Clayton, who was sleeping because it was well after midnight, but he managed to convince her to come down to the studio and record at that moment. This is not at all myth. It's total fact that she hadn't heard the song at all until she walked into the studio minutes before entering the recording booth. You know what? Hold on. This music is too fantastic to leave out of context. So here she is on the second refrain, just as a refresher. So amazing, right? That is what backing vocals are all about. Anyway, she did that in just 3 or 4 takes, and then she went home and went to sleep. Now, how you can just go to sleep after basically overshadowing Mick Jagger on a Rolling Stone song in 1969 is beyond me, but that's how it went down. Went home and went to sleep. Just a few hours later, she woke up because she didn't feel well, and yeah, she had a sudden miscarriage. After consulting with doctors, they attributed the tragedy to the force with which she was singing that night. Clayton herself agreed with the medical professionals, and for a number of years, she understandably did not perform the song. So while Gimme Shelter is by far one of the greatest moments of music history, the legend that it led to Mary Clayton losing her child is absolutely 100% true. But let's not end things on such a dark note. Let's see, something amusing. How about Neil Young? He's always doing crazy, curmudgeonly things, and there's tons of myths out there about him, so let's choose one. Well, one of the most common you'll hear is that one time he bought an entire release of one of his albums and then blew them all up with dynamite. Yeah. Now, Neil Young is, how to put this? He's a bit of a perfectionist when it comes to sound. There's a reason that albums like Harvest and After the Gold Rush sound so damn good all these decades later. Neil has an exceptional ear, and he understands how important proper fidelity is to the full experience of music. But buying a bunch of your own records is a bit, let's call it eccentric. And then destroying them? I mean, it's a bit much, don't you think? Except, of course, for the fact that this totally happened. Well, almost exactly. The year is 1978, and the album in question is called Comes a Time. The record had been completely pressed, and it was literally days before it was supposed to be released. And that's when Neil realized that he had approved a test pressing that came from a bad master tape. For those of you who don't know, and it still happens if you do analog recordings, you'll get a test pressing, which is basically kind of the final mix of the album so that you can listen to it and say, yeah, this is good, and then they send it to the pressing plant and they make thousands and thousands and thousands of copies. Now, apparently, the master tape had been damaged during shipment to the mixing facility, and Young felt that too many of the high-frequency sounds were missing from the final pressing. Neil Young lost his cool and told the label they were not allowed to release the album, and the label responded as you'd expect, asking Neil exactly what he wanted them to do with the 200,000 copies that they'd already paid to have made, and were made. The label told him that it was going to cost him $1 per copy, plus the shipping charges back from Italy and Japan, where the album had already been shipped for an earlier release date. Amazingly, Neil agreed to their fee, stating, and I quote here, "I don't like throwing money around, but I wasn't going to have this album circulating around the world in bad quality." Yeah, seriously, that's what he said, and that is when he popped down over $200,000 for it. If that's not artistic integrity, I don't know what is. Anyway, the byproduct is that Neil Young was now the proud owner of 200,000 copies of his own album. And for anyone who knows the size of a record collection, you can imagine just how much space that would occupy. I mean, we're talking a large warehouse space. So his purchase of the 200,000 records is 100% fact. But what exactly happened to them after goes in two different directions. I mean, with that many albums, you got options. In 2014, Neil told Rolling Stone that he used a bunch of these records to shingle the roof of his barn. Now, I'm not totally sure I believe this, as they'd be a pretty bad choice on a number of levels, but I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if they were somehow mixed into the shingling. But still, even with a full barn, 200,000 records is a lot of records. Thus the other claim from Neil's father. Scott Young said that in the early 80s, he and Neil were at one of the storage buildings where Neil kept things like, you know, his antique cars, other big random stuff, you know, things like that. In one of the rooms, there were just tons of boxes. And after asking what they were, Scott Young was informed that they were, in fact, the bad copies of Comes a Time. He pressed further, asking how Neil could be sure that, you know, they wouldn't be stolen or mishandled and then eventually put out into the public and heard. So Neil opened one of the boxes and showed him. What it revealed was that all of the records in that box had been shot through with a rifle, making them completely unplayable. The elder Young indicated that every single box in the storage space was in this condition, and knowing Neil Young's temperament, I tend to believe this one 100%. So while the explosions never happened, gunshots make sense, and he did in fact buy 200,000 copies of his own record. Well, that's another four myths in the books, so be sure to hit me on Twitter at GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru, and let me know what musical urban legend you want me to delve into next. There are so many great stories, and we've got plenty to come down the line. Now, before we wrap the episode, I do, of course, have your weekly EarFuel listening assignment. For those of you new to the podcast, welcome. Each week, I assign an album to listen to in full, beginning to end, without any distractions or interruptions. It stems from the fact that these days, music has been largely relegated to a background task for most people. You're driving, you're at the gym, you're at work, you're, you know, whatever. And this assignment is about taking some time each week to consciously listen to music for the sake of the music alone. This week, since fall has officially begun, and I mentioned it just a few minutes ago, your assignment is my all-time favorite Neil Young record, 1972's Harvest. Now, before I get into the music and lyrics, what I love most about this album is the mood. While the majority of the songs are softer and slower, even when the volume gets turned up, the stillness, the desolation, just this exceptional mood is never interrupted in the least. That ability to craft such a cohesive album is rarely achieved, and it's one of the reasons this record is so special, along with why it's so much better to spin during the fall and winter months. From the light opening drum sound of Out on the Weekend to the closing guitar wail of Words Between the Lines of Age, this album is Neil Young in top form, and both the lyrics and orchestrations are largely his best work to date. But some of that may be due to the outstanding backing musicians you'll find on this record. James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt are both on here, along with Tim Drummond, who studio owner Elliot Mazur pulled into the session when he saw him walking on the street. No joke, the guy was out for a walk and ended up on a Neil Young record. I guess that means we should all go outside more. I don't know, maybe only if you're a drummer. Anyway, the London Philharmonic Orchestra also appears on two songs. There's a full electric band here. But for me, it's when it's more stripped down that this record is really at its best. The small touches on the album opener, the iconic acoustic guitar on Old Man, the lonesome piano on A Man Needs a Maid. I mean, if you ever wondered what it's like to absolutely nail a mood on various instrumentations, this is a masterclass, and every orchestration is nothing short of extraordinary. Yet even more of that feeling and mood is conveyed through Neil's voice and lyrics, and they've rarely been better than you find here, really. There's this raw honesty, so his emotions can flow directly into the pen that really mesmerizes. You can feel his sadness on A Man Needs a Maid, the frustration and anger on Alabama, or just kind of the seeking of wisdom and meaning for life on many of the other tracks. But for me, the most powerful moment is undoubtedly the needle and the damage done. Now, while it's become so well known that the power within is often overlooked, it is perhaps the most raw, honest, and devastating anti-drug song ever. Sit back and just listen to the words and the pain in Neil's voice. The song is one of a kind. But that's just it with this album. Harvest may be the most heartbreakingly beautiful collection of songs in the entire history of music, and it's a reminder of just how moving music can be. I mean, it's almost overwhelming at times, and it proves just what it means to be completely unguarded and honest as a writer. The bottom line is, this is just one of those records that everyone needs to know. And if you haven't given this one a full spin lately, go change that right now. Thank me later. So that's all for this week. I've got something very, very cool coming your way next week. I cannot wait. So be sure to tune in for that. As always, the podcast is available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Earfuel, along with at getearfuel.com. That is your weekly Earfuel. Share and enjoy.